She just was the last person who should have ever died like that.
One summer night, a life comes to a sudden end.
I get very weird scream.
She had been targeted.
The suspect knew the victim.
But the trail grew cold.
I remember one detective saying to me, "We just have to wait until he kills again."
It was decades before someone took another look.
The whole goal in these cases is just trying to see the thing that's hiding in plain sight.
The clues? A weapon. A wedding invitation. A midnight sail to nowhere.
He stalked her.
My sister was afraid.
I was 100% confident that he was our guy.
A determined prosecutor faces off against O.J. Simpson's attorney.
Did I give you pause?
I'm on the right side.
Would a jury agree?
It's been a long journey.
He was alone in his makeshift workshop. Had to be, for what he intended. Carefully, he cut the lengths of a broom handle. Two of them. Just a few inches each, sanded them down, drilled a hole in each one. Found a piece of wire to string between them, too thin. He doubled it for strength. His perfect weapon for his perfect crime. Outside in the brilliant sunshine, it was the summer of 1979. AIDS hadn't happened to us yet. Nor the internet, nor cell phones, nor a way to read DNA. All of those things were still years away. Everybody worried about Three Mile Island that summer. The Iranian hostage crisis was still months away. And in Southern California in the summer of 79, in the beach towns that cling to the coast near L.A., 20-somethings came from all over to work, to play, to practice an art as old as humans and as new as last night, mating.
The area had a ski club, snow skiing, water skiing, volleyball, all sorts of outdoor activities.
Richard Frank was 32 that summer. He published an independent community newspaper, but on weekends.
We do bus trips, and guys are trying to meet girls and hit on people. It was a lot of fun.
One woman in particular caught Richard's eye.
We had a thing called Snow Queen, and she was running for Snow Queen. And she didn't win, but she was a very outgoing, gregarious, almost tomboy kind of person, attractive.
Her name was Lynn Knight. She was a neonatal nurse who, like so many here, came from somewhere else. In her case, a pretty place called Stratford, not far from Toronto, Canada.
She was beautiful, beautiful person.
This is Lynn's sister, Donna.
She was Jim Carrey before Jim Carrey was ever around. She did the goofy stuff, and everywhere people would be in stitches.
Nurses, whether funny and beautiful or not, were in great demand in the 70s. Lynn could have gone anywhere or stayed close to home, like her sister Donna, also a nurse, chose to do.
I had such difficulty when she was going to go to California. I did not want her to go. Nope.
But she did. Moved into a tiny studio apartment tacked onto the back of somebody's garage here in suburban Torrance. And she signed up at the hospital called Little Company of Mary, where she went to work with the smallest patients of all, the most vulnerable, premature babies.
Those were her babies. She took her job very seriously. She would arrive early. She would do double shifts.
All of Lynn's hard work paid off. The hospital considered her one of its top employees. She was a finalist in a nursing contest called Miss Red Rose. How she did it all is a wonder. Worked hard and played hard.
She would work midnight shift, so, and then sleep for about 3 or 4 hours, and then she'd be gone. And scuba diving, marathoning, running, you name it. Lynn was the most incredible tomboy ever.
And one more thing. She loved the company of men. Many of them, perhaps most of them, were just friends. Some more than that.
A number of them were racquetball players or skiers or whatever. So she had a lot of male friends because she was competitive in racquetball. So
but they were more friends than they were romantic partners.
Yeah. She only went out really with professionals and good-looking professionals. And then, of course, she met Richard Frank.
We hit it off pretty quickly. We dated pretty heavily for a couple of months.
Could be confusing, of course, for Richard. Not many young women with as many male friends as the crowd of them that hovered around Lynn, her sweethearts, as she called them.
One of the things was trying to find out where I fit in her life.
But with Richard, as Lynn told her sister, it was romance. Was she perhaps a little too intense? For Richard's 32-year-old single self, yes, she was.
It was a little too much in the beginning. Even her sister Donna said that, and so I kind of cut it off.
So she was just a little going too fast, is that?
Yeah.
But love has a way of circling back. Towards the end of that summer of 79, after they'd been apart for a while, they ran into each other again on a water skiing trip.
I saw her and we started talking, and we decided, you know, okay, let's go out. And it was like, for me, it was, is this the one that got away?
And then, it was August 29th, a warm summer evening outside Lynn's little studio apartment on Anza Avenue. Quiet, calm, not a breath of wind. Lynn was cooking Chinese food. She had company, a male friend who'd come for dinner, a male friend who was not Richard Frank. No, this was an ex-boyfriend named Joe Giaruso. After dinner, Lynn and Joe drank some wine, talked about what we cannot know. And then at 11:30 or so, he left, and Lynn went to bed. Early shift at the hospital. Outside, the street was silent. Wednesday ticked into Thursday. That's when the neighbors heard it. Couldn't help but hear it. A high-pitched scream. And it came from Lynn Knight's little apartment. It was a scream that would echo down through the years and change so many lives.
My whole world crashed in.
35 years later, the scene in that apartment would still leave a hardened homicide detective in tears.
That's, excuse me.
The scream was almost beyond human, shrill, harrowing, echoing through the quiet neighborhood on Anza Avenue. The man next door called 911.
I hear Mary Lou scream, you know?
Who lives there?
Lynn Knight.
When Torrance police arrived, minutes later, the little apartment was quiet again. And Lynn Knight was dead, lying on her bed in a pool of blood. Detective Emilio Perez had never seen anything quite like it.
Just terrible. Bloody, and I can't find other words to describe it other than horrific.
So horrific, said lead detective Gary Hilton, that even now, talking about it is difficult.
That's, excuse me.
Yeah.
Out of all the ones I worked, it was the toughest.
No wonder. The victim had been stabbed more than a dozen times.
Pointing toward what? Rage, the desire to see this particular individual dead.
Good and dead.
But there was another set of wounds the detectives couldn't quite figure out at first. Deep cuts on her neck, which may have explained the horrifying sound that woke up Lynn's neighbors.
How do they describe that screaming?
A squeal. A loud squeal.
After he heard that, said a neighbor, he caught a glimpse of the man who might have been the killer. A slender young man with dark curly hair. Not much to go on.
He looked at the back of the suspect as he ran down the driveway into the street.
Carrying something.
A small satchel.
But there couldn't have been much inside that little black bag because Very little was taken from Lynn's apartment, only her wallet, her keys, and one particular piece of jewelry.
She had a necklace on with a pendant. Mm-hmm. At the scene, we found the broken clasp and the pendant.
But no chain.
No chain.
But the killer left something of his own behind, something detectives didn't notice, until the coroner moved Lynn's body.
It appeared to be a homemade device used to strangle a victim. It was cut off portions of what appeared to be a broom or mop handle and a piece of wire.
Going between the two?
Yes.
So there was some planning involved?
Oh, there was a great deal of planning involved. That's a homemade garrote.
A garrote? Detective Gary Hilton hadn't seen one of those since he served in Vietnam, and certainly never at a crime scene. But now he understood why Lynn's neck was cut so deeply.
Did he actually put it around her neck, as far as you could tell?
Overkill. And that would be an understatement.
Then it was time for what was perhaps the most difficult part of all of this, making the phone call to Lynn's family in little Stratford, Ontario. A family which, until that very moment, had assumed that their precocious daughter was perfectly safe saving babies in Los Angeles.
Lynn's sister Donna was just getting off her shift at a Toronto hospital.
Got a call from my brother-in-law, and he was like gulping for air and having, you know, practically out of his skin. And he said that, I hate to have to tell you, but Lynn's been stabbed to death. And it was like, it was such a sad day.
It's not something you ever would expect to hear, no matter what.
No. It was like my whole world crashed in. And that was it. It was completely life-altering. My life has never, ever been the same since.
Donna was 26, only recently out of nursing school.
How do you even take a thing like that in?
Oh, you don't, because you go like, it's like totally out of body. You go into shock. It's complete shock. It's like also a great big hole in your chest.
Who would have done such a thing? To Lynn, the kind and compassionate nurse, not an enemy in the world. But then, before dawn, a concrete lead. Police saw someone suspicious running in Lynn's neighborhood. The same guy the neighbors saw?
A suspect was seen running from this location, carrying a black bag.
They picked him up. And, by the look of it, with blood literally on his hands. A clue found in the strangest place.
I saw this wedding invitation. It was crumbled up in the trash.
A party Lynn would never get a chance to attend. Who threw out the invitation? And why? Sometimes cops get lucky. This was recorded in the pre-dawn hours of August 30th, 1979, just after the brutal murder of Lynn Knight.
23, possible suspect, dark, curly hair, last seen running eastbound across Anson.
A patrol unit detained and arrested an individual who was acting strangely nearby.
It looked like he had blood on him.
He did.
His name was Gerardo Juarez, and he appeared to match a description of the man seen running away from Lynn's apartment. So they held Juarez for questioning. But before they got to that, they had to finish processing the crime scene at Lynn's apartment.
I found evidence of blood smears in the house. It looked like it was caused by gloves.
And there was no DNA, of course.
Back then, we didn't have DNA. All the blood found was consistent with the victim.
Remember, this was 1979, years before the advent of DNA. Fingerprints were still the gold standard back then, but only Lynn's prints were identified in her apartment. The others could not be traced back to the murder, and that apparent murder weapon, the garrote, was clean of prints. So there was planning, a lot of it, and immense brutality. But burglary? No. Only small personal items were taken. Detectives Perels and Hilton were pretty sure it could mean only one thing.
The suspect knew the victim.
She had been targeted. And I say that because the location was quite removed from the street. It was not a place where there were passersby. Someone would have to know how to go back there in order to reach the door.
So the detectives went back to the Torrance PD to talk to their possible suspect, Gerardo Juarez. He insisted he didn't know Lynn, had never even seen her, had no reason to kill her. A search of his home turned up nothing. And that blood on his hands and clothes?
It proved not to be blood.
What was it?
Could have been something like paint, dirt, mud. We just simply couldn't tie him to the crime scene.
So much for that break. Gerardo Juarez was released, and for the moment at least, they were nowhere. A few days after the murder, a small funeral was held in Stratford, Ontario. They'd been planning to have a wedding then, Donna's wedding. Lynn was supposed to have been here, alive, as her sister's maid of honor.
They dressed her in her maid of honor dress. I remember feeling such anger that whoever did that to my sister, my parents, watching my parents grieve. What has they done to my baby?
The coroner's report answered some questions. An autopsy determined that Garotte did not kill Lynn. She died of stab wounds. And the report revealed something else. Traces of two semen samples. But again, DNA testing was not available back then, so they could not attach identities to those semen samples.
So you began to talk to everybody
you knew. So that's where we started the circle of friends, acquaintances, her job, anybody that knew her.
Including all her current and former boyfriends, racquetball partners, ski buddies, work colleagues.
We needed time to develop a little bit of background on all of the various players so that we'd have some idea what questions to ask.
Yeah. Any one of whom could have been the one.
Anyone.
Mind you, Richard Frank had already called the police to offer his help and was pretty quickly eliminated. He had an alibi. But what about that old flame, Joe Giaruso? He was, without a doubt, in Lynn's apartment just hours before she was killed. The neighbors had seen him there, eating dinner. Joe told the detectives Lynn was fine when he left, about midnight.
Didn't that make you think that he might be a suspect?
Oh, yeah. He was, of course, somebody we had to investigate immediately.
So they took Joe in for questioning. He, too, seemed very forthcoming. And if he wasn't deeply upset about what happened to Lynn, he was putting on a good act. Still, the detectives noticed something strange on his fingers. Several cuts. He insisted they happened at work, in a lab where he dropped a test tube. He would never hurt Lynn, he told them. Had no reason for jealous rage.
He was in a relationship with another woman and was still visiting our victim. And apparently were friends.
By the time Lynn was murdered, said Joe, he was in bed with his girlfriend. What to make of the story? Until his alibi could be checked out, Joe Giaruso remained the only possible suspect. By this time, when the investigation had been underway for almost 2 weeks, the Knight family flew to L.A. for the grim task of packing Lynn's personal belongings.
We felt, we really, this is not nice to say, but we hated America for what happened to Lynn. And we didn't want anybody touching her stuff. And so we, as a team, cleaned up her place. And it was a really hard job.
They collected all her keepsakes and mementos, even her financial records, which said a lot about Lynn.
The sum in her bank was all of $18, because she paid for scuba diving lessons and you name it. She just did it. She was packing in every activity she could possibly pack in.
Huh.
So she really lived a lot in those 28 years.
But there was one thing Donna didn't find, something that was quite special to both sisters, the invitation to her upcoming wedding. And then Detective Hilton remembered. He spotted it in a wastebasket, though he didn't collect it as evidence.
I saw this wedding invitation that was crumpled up.
Didn't seem like a big deal at the time.
No, it was just a wedding invitation, had her name on it, and it was crumpled up in the trash.
And that's when we went, Lynn wouldn't do that. My grandparents' picture was right there, their wedding pictures. So we knew something wasn't right. And also, if it was crumpled up, who else would have the motive to crumple it up? Somebody who was ticked off that they weren't coming to this wedding.
Ticked off enough to actually kill Lynn Knight? Who was it who was left off the guest list? An old boyfriend tells a startling story. Is it also a valuable clue?
It's almost surreal knowing that the incident happened and maybe it related somehow to the crime.
This was home, lovely little Stratford, Ontario, where Lynn Knight grew up, the place she intended to return for her sister Donna's impending wedding. No wedding now.
We had to cancel the wedding, and it was just so horrible. You know, wedding's supposed to be a happy time, and...
Nothing happy about those days.
Nope.
But the wedding did offer an odd clue of sorts. Lynn's invitation, which had been found crumpled up in her wastebasket.
The question was, would she have wrinkled it up or thrown it in the trash? Or did the suspect do it?
The detectives were convinced that Lynn's killer knew her, hated her, maybe wanted revenge for something. Donna couldn't imagine who that might be.
Who would slaughter an somebody that to that degree, if they didn't have a motive, a hatred, something.
2 weeks into the investigation, the only potential suspect was Lynn's former boyfriend, Joe Giarrusso. He was with her just hours before she died. He had cuts on his fingers. And then the detectives discovered something else.
Hadn't he had a physical altercation with Lynn at some point?
There was a situation where she was... beaten up.
So, they brought Joe back in, grilled him again. He swore it wasn't a beating at all, but a minor thing, a slap during an argument. And afterwards, he and Lynn remained close friends. Besides, said Joe and his girlfriend, they were in bed together when the murder happened. They volunteered to take a polygraph, and...
They both passed.
And soon after that, Joe Giarrusso, who... after all, didn't look anything like the man the neighbors saw after the attack, was eliminated as a suspect. In fact, one by one, just about all of Lynn's male friends came up clean and seemed to want to do whatever they could to help find her killer.
They all had good things to say. I thought that was unusual to talk to 12 men who dated her or knew her, and nobody had a bad word.
And that, of course, included her athletic new beau, Richard Frank, who had rekindled his romance with Lynn just a week before her murder.
It's devastating. It's almost surreal knowing that the incident happened and maybe it related somehow to the crime.
The incident. Richard told police about a bizarre encounter he and Lynn had a couple of months earlier at her apartment. A guy she once dated stopped by to drop off a lamp he had borrowed.
And he, words to the effect, excuse me, thank you, and he left.
But minutes later, he was back.
And he comes in and he starts yelling at her and he's calling her a whore and took the lamp and threw it over our heads and was pretty violent with all of this and then left. You can hear the tires squeal.
What was that all about?
And she explained it to somebody that she's been trying to cut it off with.
Lynn told Richard that the guy's name was Doug, and they had dated for a few months, but just the day before Richard came to call, she broke it off. Apparently, Doug didn't take it so well.
That particular night, do you remember her reaction then?
Obviously, she was scared.
Was it scary to you too?
I was concerned. I was concerned for Lynn.
In the days that followed, the incident seemed to be forgotten, at least as far as Lynn was concerned.
She had this calming way of taking big things and making small things out of them. She was in control. Later on, she explained that, you know, she calmed him down on the phone a couple of times. And
after that incident?
Yeah, and she thought it was kind of taken care of.
Detectives were intrigued. They found Lynn's address book in her purse. Only one Doug Bradford. They asked Donna about him, and she vaguely remembered something Lynn mentioned in a letter.
Saying that Doug was no longer coming to the wedding.
Okay.
And that he was on the back burner. I mean, I just sort of put it out of my mind because I had all this wedding and to organize. I knew, you know, obviously he didn't light her fire too much.
This was the first bit of heat on a cold trail. They gave Doug a call. He lived with his parents. He sounded shy, but agreed to meet at the house, where, it turned out, Doug Bradford had a lot to say. It's the kind of trick cops always use in the movies.
We're not going to tell them that she's dead.
See if it works in real life. It was a less congested drive in those days, back in 79. The cruise down the freeway from Torrance to Costa Mesa, California. This, the working-class midsection of sprawling Orange County. Detectives Gary Hilton and Emilio Perez parked in front of a modest house where a 27-year-old engineering student named Doug Bradford lived with his parents.
He seemed somewhat meek, somewhat soft-spoken. Kind of a neatnik sort of a guy.
Nerdy kind of character?
You could say that. An engineering type of person.
Nothing about Doug Bradford made him look or sound or act like a potential suspect. No, he was clearly a smart and pretty civilized guy. Well, the only cool thing about Doug was his car, a bright orange 280Z. Lustworthy back in 79. Still, according to Richard Frank, this same Doug had engaged in a very uncivilized lamp-throwing tantrum in Lynn's apartment. So he was a guy they had to look at. Besides, at some point, Lynn was something of a big deal in Doug's life.
She had spent Easter at his home with his family. They were fairly close. The fact that he would have introduced Lynn to his family is somewhat telling.
This is a serious relationship.
I think he wanted it to be.
Lynn, too, apparently. Why else would she have invited him to tag along to her sister Donna's wedding up in Canada? So, knowing that much... Wait, back up the freeway a bit. Something else you need to know. Gary Hilton's detective mind was oddly creative, sometimes in ways other cops didn't quite get. Hilton, knowing the case hadn't got much news coverage, hatched a plan on the way to the interview.
We're not going to tell him that she's dead, and that we were there investigating a missing person.
Just a friendly chat about a missing woman, a missing ex-girlfriend. If he was involved in the murder, how might he react to that? Give something away, maybe?
There was no giving of Miranda rights.
Right.
He was in his own home. He was voluntarily cooperating. He could have stopped the interview at any time, but he opted not to do that. He wanted to speak. And he did.
So, asked the detectives, what did they do when they dated, he and Lynn?
We'd go out to dinner quite a bit. We went flying, took her sailing. We went skiing locally here, go out and go dancing.
As for the relationship, it was exclusive, said Doug, more or less.
Did she go out with other men?
Well, not to the best of my knowledge, at least when I was dating her. She used to kid me about it and say, no, you know, you don't have anything to worry about. But, yeah, I guess she might have gone out with some men.
With Lynn, it was just fun, said Doug. Active. Lots of laughs. But he never did consider Lynn to be the love of his life. And sure enough, he said, she wasn't.
Could you say which one of the two of you was more decisive about breaking off the relationship?
I think that Lynn was more decisive. I was just kind of going along with it, and I kind of saw that the relationship was going to come to an end.
That became very obvious out in Palm Springs one weekend a few months into their relationship, said Doug. It just didn't seem to be clicking anymore.
And we decided that we should go our own ways. And that was it.
That was the last time you saw her?
Mm-hmm.
But wait. Unless Richard Frank was lying, Doug showed up at Lynn's place the very next day to return a lamp, saw Richard, and flew into a rage, throwing the lamp across the room. So, what about that? They asked Doug. There was no rage at all, he said. Disappointment, maybe?
Well, I don't know if I was really mad. I was just more upset about it. She was, you know, more jumping from one relationship to the next, so I left. That's the last I saw her.
And then Doug said something kind of strange. Remember now, Detective Hilton had decided not to tell Doug that Lynn was dead, rather that she was missing. Listen to this.
I don't have any reason to ever see her again or want to see her again. You know, just dead and something I want to put out of my mind.
She's dead? Why would he say that? The cops didn't follow up, worried Bradford might clam up. Then, as detectives were about to grill Bradford concerning his whereabouts the night Lynn supposedly went missing, an unfortunate surprise.
The tape recorder started making some strange sounds. Oh, boy. And when it failed, we had to stop.
So they waited a few days, did some research on Doug Bradford, discovered he liked to play jazz on the piano, was an expert sailor in addition to his engineering studies and his tinkering. He liked to make things. He was accomplished. Donna, however, didn't like him much. Not a good fit for Lynn.
I can see why she would have not wanted to go with Bradford, because it wasn't her usual type, but it was a rebound relationship.
But what mattered now was Doug's alibi, if he had one. So detectives drove down to Costa Mesa again, worried he'd refuse to see them or demand a lawyer. But he didn't. Instead, Doug Bradford told them a story of his own, which put him miles and miles from the murder of Lynn Knight. Doug Bradford's odd alibi.
I didn't get much sleep that night.
No, I was sore in my shoulder. It was quite a night.
Torrance police detectives were a little surprised Doug Bradford agreed to talk to them a second time. And here they were back in Costa Mesa with their new recorder. Again, Doug described how he and Lynn had once been close, how he liked to buy her presents.
I've given her a necklace,
a type of necklace, was it?
Well, actually, I didn't give it to her. I helped her buy it, because she picked it out.
Now that caught the cop's attention, a necklace, which just happened to be the one piece of jewelry that appeared to be missing from Lynn's apartment. Pendant and clasp were collected, but no chain. Interesting. But now the real reason they were here, to find out where Doug was the night Lynn was murdered.
Last week on Wednesday night, could you tell me what your activities were?
Well, I was here most of the evening. And then I went up to Long Beach for a little bit. I went sailing and I came back. I got back here a little after 3.
Sailing? In the wee hours of the morning, in the dark, alone, out there on the Pacific Ocean? Odd, maybe, but after all, Doug belonged to a local sailing club, so he had access to a sailboat any old time he wanted one. That night, said Doug, he took out a 30-foot sloop, a special type of racing boat known as a Shields.
Did you go under sail that night?
Well, I started off under sail, but I ended up coming back under paddle power. There was no auxiliary power in it. I got there without any wind.
And then you arrived back in there at
that time? That time I got the boat put away. It could have been 1:30, 2 o'clock.
Which was right around the time Lynn was murdered.
I didn't get much sleep that night.
No, and I was sore, my shoulders. I think that was quite a night.
This going out by himself on a 30-foot sloop with no motor, right?
No motor, no. No auxiliary power, as he put it.
Mind you, Doug was an expert skipper, said he knew how to paddle the Shields. But the detectives didn't like it, this too perfect, too weird alibi.
It didn't make sense to me then, and it doesn't make sense to me now.
So they paid a visit to the boat club, where Doug claimed to have set sail that night.
We obtained one of the records showing that he had signed out for the boat.
They asked another skipper, was a 30-foot Shields a boat a skilled sailor could handle alone?
And his comment was, oh yeah, you could. Yeah, you could sail this by yourself.
So that was the alibi. A penciled mark in a sailboat schedule book and Doug's claim that he sailed alone that night.
He could never come up with anybody who actually saw him take the boat out.
No, he said he was the only one there.
Maybe nobody saw Doug sailing. But there were reports he was seen driving in front of Lynn's apartment just days before the murder. Now that was interesting, because remember, Doug told detectives he cut off all contact with Lynn after their breakup. So they checked with Lynn's neighbors and showed them a photo of Doug in his 280Z, and
I got a witness to identify Mr. Bradford as the person who had been seen driving back and forth in front of the residence, looking up the driveway.
He wouldn't leave her alone.
He wouldn't leave her alone. As a matter of fact, he stalked her.
Stalked her?
Yes, before the murder.
Which might explain, said her sister Donna, why Lynn stayed with a number of male friends for several nights before the murder.
I know that the last week of her life, it looks like she, you know, slept with a lot of men, and that's not true. When I look at the pattern, my sister was afraid. She was scared.
So maybe Doug's 280Z would yield a clue for detectives. They got a warrant, but
it was just as clean as a whistle.
There was no evidence in it at all.
None that we were able to recover. And there was no blood found. There was no sign of anything there.
And whoever attacked her would have been covered with blood.
You would conclude that, yes.
But the cops couldn't help but notice the smell in that 280Z.
When we opened it up, it was just an overwhelming smell of Armor All.
It had just been cleaned.
Detail. It was a clean car.
And after that, there was no talking to Doug Bradford anymore.
I received a phone call from an attorney, said he was representing Doug Bradford, and told me to don't do anything with regard to my client unless you call me first.
It seemed pretty clear that you were after him.
He was number one, as I put it.
So, the detectives took their case to the DA with a request to charge Doug Bradford with murder. But
all the district attorneys pretty much said there just wasn't enough.
Yeah.
They needed that. They call it the smoking gun.
We were sent back and told to do additional investigation and bring it back.
Which they did, but always the answer was the same.
That hurt. It hurt.
Well, you couldn't put that guy in that room on that night.
True. It was heavily circumstantial.
It wasn't just the detectives who were disappointed. Donna was convinced Doug Bradford killed her sister. But she wasn't holding her breath for justice to be done.
I said to my mom, there's not going to be arrest for 20, 25 years or more. I just know it, Mom. Just get used to it. It's not going to happen.
She was certainly right about that. After 3 years, in 1982, the investigation into the murder of Lynn Knight was classified as inactive a nice way of saying it was over. And no one saw the tantalizing clue hiding in plain sight.
It's a terrible thing when a murder goes unsolved, justice undone. Especially a murder as vicious and intentional as what happened to Lynn Knight in her tiny Torrance apartment in the summer of 79. Lynn's family up in Canada could scarcely stand it.
Every time you think about it, you shudder, and then it's like Niagara Falls, and you're at the bottom, and it's all coming at you at a terrible, horrible, horrible experience. She just was the last person who should have ever died like that.
As the 80s rolled out their own catalog of horrors, AIDS, drugs, urban decay, rampant and growing crime, Donna fought to keep her sister's memory from sinking under the weight of so many other troubles. She wrote letters, lots of them, and enlisted Lynn to help.
I got that nice picture of Lynn, and I pasted there, and I thought, sell yourself, Lynn. Here goes. I'm just going to send it.
And you sent them where?
The governor, the FBI. I have nothing to lose.
Well, you even wrote to who? Ronald Reagan?
Yes. Thought I got to go to key decision makers.
But she was shouting in the wind. Detectives Hilton and Perels retired. Not happy about what they left behind.
This one weighed on me for quite a long time. It nags you in the back of your head. You don't want to leave a homicide case undone. That's just wrong.
Lead detective Gary Hilton second-guessed himself endlessly. Still does.
I could have been a little bit more, done a little bit more. I just got to know Lynn Knight. Just a little personally. Too bad I didn't know her in life.
Occasionally, a new set of detectives would dust off the file and tell Donna they were optimistic about cracking it.
So it was just like, oh, here we go again. But I remember one detective saying to me, we just have to wait until he kills again. And I went, no, this is not going to happen. This is not going to happen. There has got to be an answer.
And Doug Bradford, the man cops long suspected of murdering Lynn, he did quite well for himself, owned a successful high-tech company, a nice house in California, had a young wife. And Richard Frank, remember him? The man Lynn started seeing again just days before her death? He, too, had moved on, got married, raised a family, owned a successful newspaper business, but occasionally thought about her and what happened.
I drove by the neighborhood a lot because I worked in that area, so that would be a constant reminder.
You just wondered.
Yeah, I'd call the detectives every once in a while, anything new.
Nearly two decades went by. It was 1997. Someone found a little extra money for the Torrance Police Department to open a cold case unit.
When we first opened this detail, we started looking at about 30 cases, and this was one of the very first ones we did.
And that's when Detective Jim Wallace heard about Lynn from her sister Donna. Wallace likes to work crimes with his brain. He's cerebral. But what he saw at that file hit at a baser level.
The cases I've worked, I'm just going to tell you, this is the most horrific, powerful, terrifying crime scene I've ever seen. There's something about the horror that Lynn went through that was still evident in the crime scene. Mm-hmm. The ghost of this scene was still there.
A ghost, maybe, but virtually no hard evidence. So Wallace went back to the beginning and took a good look at Lynn and the company she kept. Wallace re-interviewed all of Lynn's surviving boyfriends.
They were very happy with the kind of relationship they had with Lynn, and everyone would tell you that.
Except for two, about whom they couldn't know. Joe Giarusso, the man she invited in for dinner the last night of her life, had since died. No way to talk to him. And then there was Doug Bradford, the ex-boyfriend who threw the lamp and was seen driving near Lynn's apartment in the days before her murder, and had offered that odd alibi about sailing and paddling a 30-foot sloop in the middle of the night.
I think there's always a rational element in these kinds of circumstantial cases, because anything is possible, but not anything is reasonable. And this case was one of those where you really had to ask, is it possible that somebody would go out on a boat at 10:30 at night? Oh, absolutely. Is that reasonable? No.
Wallace could see why the initial investigation focused on Bradford, but this wouldn't be easy. Which he knew was catnip for Deputy District Attorney John Lewin.
The cases that I enjoy are lots of little pieces, and if I get too big of a piece, it's not as challenging, you know, to work.
So Lewin read the file too. And right away it looked to him like Joe Giarusso could have been the killer. But then he listened to those original 1979 interviews with Doug Bradford.
You know, just dead and something I want to put out of my mind.
I was 100% confident that he was our guy. It wasn't just the fact that his statement was so creepy and so incriminating. It was when you mix that with his alibi, it was absurd. The fact that he was the only person in her life that had motive.
But proving it? Creepy and absurd are not exactly legal terms. His boss, the district attorney, would laugh Lewin out of his office if he didn't come up with something new to connect Bradford to the crime. So bit by bit, over years, Lewin and Wallace and his partner worked the case like a big jigsaw puzzle with missing pieces. But one didn't quite fit. Such a brutal crime committed by a nerdy engineer.
One of the big problems that I had was when you looked at Doug Bradford, he looked like a normal, regular guy who could live next door.
Sure.
This is a guy who builds a weapon to go over to murder and then mutilate someone after they're dead. In my 20 years of doing this, one of the worst scenes I've ever encountered.
That weapon, the homemade wire and wood garrote, had been a mute resident in the evidence locker for a long, long time. Wallace couldn't stop looking at it, as if it could talk.
The whole goal in these cases, right, is trying to see the thing that's hiding in plain sight.
So, the killer's garrote was made with wooden dowels that were connected by a very thin piece of wire, a double strand. Wait, double?
Why would you double it? Because apparently you recognize this is so thin, it's probably going to break if it's by itself. So why not just use thicker wire? Well, that makes sense to me, that you're using something that's available to you, that's not ideal, but you happen to have it on hand, so I'll just settle for it.
Same thing with the handles, like the killer cut pieces from a household broom.
We could see, forensically, blue specks of paint that had almost been sanded off completely, but not completely. So I'm just thinking, this looks like something that you're making from available materials. And that's what gave us the idea. Wow, maybe these available materials are just junk that's still lying around. Let's just take a look and see.
Doug Bradford moved out of that house years earlier, but his elderly mother still lived there.
Is it possible that some of the simple building materials you would use to build a garage might still be tucked away in some old drawer, stuck in the side of the garage? It's worth a look.
Anyway, Wallace and his partner ran the idea by Deputy D.A. Lewin, who liked it.
A best case scenario, can we actually find, you know, the same wire, the same doweling?
Right.
And 2007, they served the warrant.
But really? By then, nearly three decades had passed. So what in the world would they find in that little house in Costa Mesa? Something old.
What are the odds of anyone keeping it that long?
Something new.
She would know about his relationship with Lynn.
Some people are just really bad at taking a hint.
Know the type? Won't take no for an answer? By the time the Christmas lights went up in Torrance, California, end of 2007, Lynn Knight had been lying in the cold Canadian ground for 28 years. A renewed murder investigation had gone in empty circles for a decade. And though neither D.A. John Lewin nor Detective Jim Wallace seemed capable of giving up on it, they couldn't charge Doug Bradford with murder based on mere suspicion. So, one last effort. They got a warrant. Two warrants, actually. First, Wallace and his partner went to pay a surprise visit to Doug Bradford's current house with a hidden microphone. And they asked him about Lynn's case.
I would have guessed that was solved. I hadn't heard anything more.
So I wonder if we could have a few moments to see what you remember from back in 79.
Well, I've been advised by counsel not to have any further discussions about that case.
Oh, really?
Which was just the reaction the detectives expected. So they showed him their search warrant and set about poking around. Snapped a few pictures of the place, including one of Doug sitting and steaming in his living room. They found several firearms, all legal, and in a file cabinet, two articles on polygraph tests. Odd. Back in 79, Doug initially agreed to take one, and then changed his mind.
And then right next to that file was another file that had a brochure on a crossbow. And then even more disturbing, literally a manual on how to build a crossbow. So again, that was...
Interesting, except he didn't make a crossbow.
Well, what it showed was whether he made the crossbow or not, I'm pretty confident if I came into your house right now, I would not find manuals on how to make exotic weapons.
But there was nothing in Doug's house related to that other exotic weapon, the garrote. So what little optimism the detectives brought with them began to evaporate. But they had a second warrant, remember? For the very place Doug lived when Lynn Knight was murdered. His father had died, but his mother Norma still lived in the same house all these years later.
What's the problem?
It's an old 1979 murder case that we are revisiting.
Norma Bradford was no slouch. Could see this might be trouble for Doug. A woman doesn't stop being a mother just because her son is 56.
He is the straightest, straight arrow person we ever want to know.
We knew there might be a number of things she could tell us. She would know about his relationship with Lynn.
Now, had you met this nurse?
Yeah. She came in here. Doug brought her in.
Oh, he did.
She was really something.
Now, that was interesting.
We had two stories, in essence. A story from Doug in 1979 that really this was not a relationship he cared about. But she offered that Doug really thought this was a keeper, somebody, she really thought she had something special here with Lynn. And he was attracted to her in that way.
Then, as they filed that nugget away, they looked around and couldn't help but see the veritable gallery of oil paintings hung around the house. Norma revealed that the artist was her. She loved to paint. And both her late husband and Doug took pride in framing and hanging them.
She had one room that was basically like a small museum of her paintings.
Could the paintings hold a clue? Wallace suddenly turned art collector and decided to take a few of them to the police station. And then they went out to Norma's garage. All kinds of old stuff lying around. Looked like nobody had thrown anything away for quite a while. And tucked away in the corner, there they were.
We found a number of wooden dowels, and not all of them were painted. Only one was, and it was blue. And it was a broom handle, so we collected it.
Who would have believed it? Almost 30 years later, it seemed pretty obvious that the broom handle used to make the garrote was still there. The broom handle was blue. The garrote handles had been sanded down, but specks of paint still clung to them. Blue paint.
Oh, my gosh. We were so excited. We had expectations. That's why we wrote a warrant. But we didn't expect those expectations to be met with the actual wooden dowel that was used to build the... I mean, what are the odds of anyone keeping it that long.
Sure.
But it looked old.
But there's your case.
We thought this was going to be a pretty good piece of evidence. The kind of wood it is, the graining even, we were that excited.
All Wallace needed was a testing lab to confirm it, and prosecutor John Lewin would finally have the evidence he needed to file the case.
So we were thinking, okay. And you looked at it, it's blue paint, it's a dowel, you know, you have it, there's a cut one in the garage. It looked like they were going to be the same.
Lewin was excited, but also disturbed by what he saw. When he compared the two dowel samples, he noticed that the one from the garage had been sanded. Person gets a chill when the mind registers a thing like that.
Why would he take the time to sand it down? And the answer is just horrifying.
Horrifying? How? What do you mean?
The killer made this weapon because he's enjoying the process of I'm making this weapon that I'm going to use to wrap around her neck and kill her. This is a weapon that someone took time to make and that someone really cared about, I'm going to perfect it.
But now, here it was, the evidence that could put Doug Bradford at the crime scene. They sent the samples to a specialized lab outside Chicago for comparison testing.
We are expecting that we're going to get a match.
But
we didn't.
The lab report was unequivocal. These were two distinctly different dowels. They did not match. And now, suddenly, there was no case.
It was, you know, it was getting kicked in the stomach.
I can tell you, we were deflated beyond words. And so the expectations we had then, when we had no match, was that this case was dead.
Maybe the wood wasn't a match, but maybe something else was.
I went down to the local hardware store, and I said, gee, let me see if I can find picture hanging wire.
Over 10 years of effort, and they were right back at square one. At which point, it would have made perfect sense, frankly, to give it up. Stuff the Lynn Knight file back into the purgatory of unsolved cases. Or not.
I started to kind of look at the case to say, well, what do we have?
Jim Wallace picked himself up from his disappointment and poked around at the bits and pieces he might be able to build into a case, like the bit that never made sense to him. Doug Bradford's alibi. Who sails a 30-foot racing sloop alone at night and then is able to paddle it back in? The alibi checked out way back in 79. But still, some alibis can be faked, can't they? Was this one? Wallace took a crash course in boating to find out and sought any skipper he could find who knew something about sailing back in 1979.
And I called every one of them and interviewed them and asked them, I don't know anything about sailing, teach me.
One of his teachers was Charlie Abbott, once an officer in the very same sailing club that Doug used to belong to and where the Shields racing boat was docked.
Sailing at night after 10 p.m. in Southern California is kind of a fool's errand.
The Shields is hard to sail alone to begin with, and at night you need lights. So if you're going out in Southern California in the summertime, there's not going to be any wind at all, or a very little bit.
Sailors have an expression for that.
No blow, no go means if there's not enough wind, we're not going sailing.
But Doug was an expert after all. If anybody could sail after sunset, he could. Listen again to his version of what happened that night out in the dark Pacific.
Well, I started off under sail, but I ended up coming back under paddle power. There was no auxiliary power. I was out there without any wind.
About what time did you leave in Marina Valley?
It was a little after 10:30, probably.
If it's not windy already and it's 10:30 and you're standing at that dock and you're asking yourself, wow, is there enough wind for me to sail? I can maybe barely get out. Do you expect it to get better once you get out there? And everyone I talked to said, no, that's crazy. As a matter of fact, that's the one thing that was a consistent statement from every sailor. Would you do this? No.
Not to mention paddling a 2-ton boat with one little oar. Who could do that on the ocean in the dark? And yet there it was. Doug's name on the reservation form. A clear record that he booked out the boat the night Lynn was killed.
So, next question. Could he have faked his sailing reservation that night? As a club member, Doug did have access to the reservation book, so he could have inserted his name even a couple of days after the murder. Didn't mean he did, but he could have. But then they discovered something with Doug's name all over it. Very intriguing. All the reservations from 1979.
So it was just serendipitous. We had them, and we found him.
Because when Wallace reviewed all of Doug's sailboat bookings, what do you know? There was a very distinctive pattern.
Doug consistently reserved the boat on weekends. The first week that he begins to change his reservation pattern is the week of the murder. The fact that there's nobody who ever reserves the boat for a post-sunset sail except for one person, Doug Bradford, on the night of the murder.
Now that could be useful evidence. Certainly weakened Doug's alibi, but conviction material? No. As for possible DNA, there was all that blood spattered around the apartment and those two semen samples recovered from Lynn. With DNA testing now available, could they connect something at the crime scene to Doug Bradford?
Detectives went out and they got samples from all the boyfriends.
Including, of course, Doug, who was served with another search warrant at his house, this time seeking a swab of his saliva.
So this is an opportunity for us to kind of say, hey, you're not the guy, let's just move on with it.
Well, I thought that had already been determined.
One by one, the DNA results came in from all of Lynn's old lovers and male friends, and none of them matched the DNA from the crime scene, including Doug Bradford.
It definitely was problematic because, unfortunately, the more testing we were doing, we were getting DNA. So there was DNA in the semen.
Sure.
Belonging to two males.
But not him.
It just wasn't him. So yeah, it was definitely disappointing. And I knew that what I really needed was some piece of new evidence that would help.
Something physical, something forensic they could take to the L.A. County District Attorney.
You have to sell this thing, though, to your bosses, right?
Yeah, I do. I do.
But still, Wallace could not get his mind off that garrote. He must have missed something. Wallace now went to his own workshop and started tinkering. Made a garrote, and then another, and another, to understand the mindset of the killer and the materials he used. He examined the wire very closely. Then he looked again at the pictures Doug's mother painted and the wire Doug used to hang them. And both wires were the same type, something called grade number 1 8-strand braided wire.
That's the kind of wire used in the garrote, and that's also the kind of wire that Doug's mom was using to hang many of her paintings.
An exciting discovery. Well, maybe. But like the dowels, it could also be pure coincidence. How to tell?
And as I thought about it, I said, wow, I wonder how rare that wire really is. So I went down to the local hardware store. And I said, gee, let me see if I can find picture hanging wire. I found some, but not number one braided. I couldn't find it anywhere. And I started calling those manufacturers to ask them, do you guys sell a thinner wire?
Very uncommon.
Very uncommon.
So uncommon that of all the picture hanging wire sold, this particular wire only accounts for 1% to 6% of sales.
It's that rare. Yet, that's what's being used to build the garrote, and that happens to also be what Doug had access to because of his mom's painting.
Not like DNA, of course, but what they call a class match. Was it enough, along with everything else, to get Lewin to take the case to court?
When I got done with the work on the wire, with the work on the alibi, with the work on the garrote, I felt like we had a fileable case, and I brought it to John.
Now, at this point, a more conservative prosecutor might have told him forget it. But Lewin? Lewin likes tough circumstantial cases. He said yes, and took the case to his boss at the district attorney's office.
The decision to file the case was based on, well, it was based on everything.
On everything.
And so in May 2009, almost 30 years after Lynn's murder, a warrant was issued for the arrest of Douglas Gordon Bradford. Word traveled fast to Canada.
And there was a message from, call Detective Wallace. And I'll tell you, it was electric. There was so much electricity in the air, and the church wind chimes on my back veranda were just ringing away like crazy. And it was just, wow. And the arrest, it was like, yes! You know, they got him. They finally got him.
Well, maybe. Quite possible Lewin had bitten off more than he could chew this time. Because Doc Bradford had hired one of the most prominent and experienced defense attorneys in the land, a man who had won more than his share of high-profile cases, clearing celebrity clients who faced much steeper odds than a middle-aged engineer named Doug Bradford.
I asked him, "Do you have an attorney?" "Yeah." "Does he have a name?" "Yeah." "What's his name?" "Bob."
"Bob who? You'll know." For 30 years, he built a life, started an engineering business, made it successful, got married, obeyed the law, and maintained with absolute consistency that he had nothing whatever to do with the brutal murder of his one-time girlfriend, the Canadian nurse, Lynn Knight.
7825, code 6311.
Now, Doug Bradford was in the back of a squad car facing a charge of first-degree murder.
You know, he was calm the whole way. He was defiant the whole way. He never wanted to talk to us.
Although, he did say one thing, which certainly got Detective Wallace's attention.
I asked him, "Do you have an attorney?" "Yeah." "Does he have a name?" "Yeah." "What's his name?" "Bob." I said, "Okay. Do you have a last name?" "I have his card." And sure enough, of course, I get the card out. It's Robert Shapiro.
Yes, that Robert Shapiro, the lawyer who represented O.J. Simpson, the man who founded LegalZoom.
At LegalZoom.com, we put the law on your side.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Here was a true courtroom celebrity. Robert Shapiro, been practicing law for nearly 50 years, had represented scores of Hollywood's rich and famous, including, of course, O.J. Simpson.
O.J. will do everything he can to cooperate with them to help solve this horrible murder.
Almost 20 years now since he helped engineer Simpson's acquittal in the infamous trial of the century. Lynn's sister Donna was well aware of Shapiro's reputation.
I certainly wasn't going to be intimidated by Robert Shapiro.
Maybe she should have been.
Bob Shapiro?
Once Shapiro stepped in, Doug Bradford was out on bail within hours. And the outlook for the trial? Well, if there was a mountain of evidence against O.J., the circumstantial bits and pieces piled up against Doug Bradford amounted to a foothill. Maybe.
It'd be nice if we had a piece of physical evidence that would lock it in, or a witness who could say, "Oh, I saw him leaving the, you know, that so-and-so." And we never have those, being completely circumstantial.
Lewin was eager to get to trial, but the defense, not so much. Robert Shapiro thought the evidence insufficient to charge Doug Bradford or put on a trial at all. So he papered the court with motions, seeking to have the case dismissed, given its age and the lack of new physical evidence. And though his requests were denied, they took time. Lots of time. A year went by, then two, then five. Doug Bradford remained free on bail as the case crept slowly toward trial. More than 2,000 miles north across the border, Donna waited patiently in Canada, bracing for a trial over three decades in the making, this coldest of cold cases.
It wasn't cold. It's never cold to me.
No?
No.
Then, finally, July 2014, it had taken 35 years to get here. L.A. County Courtroom, Department 103. Story defense attorney Robert Shapiro versus the DA who liked circumstantial cases, John Lewin. Shapiro had already announced this would be his very last criminal case. It was also the very last one of Detective Jim Wallace's long career. He'd be testifying from retirement as a private citizen, a cop no longer.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And so they all assemble in the very courtroom where Robert Shapiro helped acquit O.J. Simpson. And sitting in the gallery, what was left of Lynn Knight's family, though Donna's mother, dead almost 9 years, was certainly on Donna's mind.
Towards the end, we had a lot of mother-daughter talks, and she grabbed my hand and she goes, "You got him, kid. I know you got him." And so my mom died knowing. She knew.
Here, for the very first time, Lynn's family got a look at the man accused of killing her, the man once invited to Donna's wedding.
I really felt I was able to look him in the eye and say a lot of things in my head that he wasn't hearing and that weren't polite.
Prosecutor John Lewin would have to sell what was perhaps the most completely circumstantial case of his career. He enlisted co-counsel Ethan Milius to help him.
With cases like this, cold cases, you never have one witness. You have a whole bunch of pieces, and on the surface, they don't appear to be connected. It's our job to connect them all together, to put it together to give you the final piece.
So, no smoking gun, but then there really aren't any.
The whole thing is a smoking gun.
Lewin fired the opening shot.
The evidence will show, ladies and gentlemen, beyond any reasonable doubt, that this man, Douglas Bradford, on August 30th, 1979, in the middle of the night, crept in there with that handmade garrote, got her while she was sleeping, and brutally murdered her.
Then more than 20 witnesses paraded by, each to recount a memory or offer an opinion, one tiny piece of the whole.
People call Detective Gary Hilton, Your Honor.
Gary Hilton was 72 now, still tormented by his inability to close the case. So, in a way, he was trying to clear his conscience here.
When I saw Lynn Knight's body, I'd never seen anybody so bad off. She was sliced, diced, and butchered.
I wanted to be there for Lynn. It was all these people talking about her, how great she was. I knew her. You know, I knew her.
Donna testified about her sister Lynn and 35 years of deep suspicion, beginning with what Doug Bradford didn't do.
At the time, did you notice that one acknowledgement of condolence was conspicuously absent?
Yes. Absolutely nothing, not a phone call, nothing, not a card from Doug Bradford.
Richard Frank, Lynn's last love interest, testified about the day he said he saw Doug Bradford fly into a rage just after Lynn dropped him.
Nobody had ever really seen him violent, and I had.
Came to the sliding glass door and tore off the screen, opened up the door, shouted, ranted, I think broke a lamp. He was incredibly upset. It was scary.
It was jealous rage, said the prosecution. Rage that inspired Doug to make a garrote using materials he found in his mother's garage. And his alibi? That story that he went sailing at night, paddled a 2-ton racing boat, couldn't have killed Lynn? Lewin called several sailing experts from local marinas, who testified that the alibi was wildly improbable.
It was so absurd that they would almost recoil, in essence going, this is stupid, why are you asking me this?
All the while, Doug Bradford watched quietly, listened intently, seemed almost aloof, except perhaps when it came to Donna.
We had some stare-down competitions. I wanted to look in his eyes, but I really wanted to see in his eyes, in his body language, whether he killed my sister.
And did you see that?
Yes. I'm going to get off because I got Shapiro.
If that's what he was trying to say, it was not without good cause. Because
Robert Shapiro had a defense strategy ready, featuring a special videotape supporting Doug Bradford's alibi. A tape that just might help him sail free.
A picture's worth a thousand words.
The famed attorney in the spotlight, and the jury gets the last word.
When they walked out, I studied their faces and I went, oh no.
Now it was Robert Shapiro's turn. His last criminal case in the same courtroom where he won, arguably, his greatest legal battle against what was labeled then a mountain of physical evidence. 71 now, still sharp, a formidable presence in the courtroom. In this case, there were implications, accusations, opinions, and almost no physical evidence at all. That glaring truth is where Robert Shapiro began to fashion what he hoped would be his final victory in criminal court.
At least six fingerprints were found. No match to Doug. Blood. No match to Doug. DNA. The Holy Grail. No match to Doug.
The wire used in the garrote, despite what the prosecution said, they couldn't prove was an exact match with the wire found on the back of his mother's paintings.
Can't match. Why? Because wire can't be matched.
But above all, said Shapiro, Doug Bradford wasn't there at Lynn's apartment the night she was murdered. His alibi was solid. He was sailing that night and then paddling his 30-foot shield.
We're going to prove to you to an absolute certainty that not only can you paddle this boat,
Doug Bradford told the truth.
His proof? Video, produced by the Shapiro office, showing a 2-ton Shields boat being paddled by one person, just as Doug Bradford claimed he did on the night of Lynn's murder.
A picture's worth a thousand words.
But what Shapiro didn't reveal to the jury was that the footage was all shot in the harbor, not far out in the ocean. And even the skipper he hired to perform the paddling admitted on the stand that nobody sails at night with no wind. And then came another stumble. Shapiro, famous for tripping up prosecution witnesses on the stand, called his own weather expert, who testified there was enough wind to sail that night, a breeze of 5 to 10 miles an hour. But D.A. Lewin had done his homework and discovered that some of the wind locations the expert cited were nowhere near the area where Doug said he was sailing.
32.7 north, 117.5 west. Do you know how many miles that was?
I don't have the chart in front of me, but
86.6 miles. Guess what landmass it's closest to?
Baja, Mexico.
Mexico. Listen, I'll give you credit. It's the right continent.
It was a careless estimate that I made because I didn't look at it carefully enough.
A careless mistake, maybe. But Shapiro told the jury it did not change the fact the prosecution could not and did not prove that Doug Bradford killed Lynn Knight.
Justice delayed has been justice denied, but now it's time for justice. There's an old Indian saying, do not judge a man until you walk a mile in his shoes.
The prosecution gets the last word, of course. Here's co-counsel Ethan Milius.
He fashioned a garrote. Made it from hand, held it, crafted it, fantasized about putting her out of his mind by ending her life.
And finally, John Lewin. 35 years of getting away with murder, he said, had to end.
He's had his trial. It is time. It is time that he is held accountable for what he did. He is a murderous monster. He needs to be held accountable. It's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
We look forward to the jury verdict.
On his way out of the courtroom,
A confident Doug Bradford stopped to answer one question.
Are you an innocent man?
Absolutely.
Donna looked forward too, with considerable anxiety.
And I just hope that we get some peace of mind. Lynn gets her soul, has a chance to rest, and my mother's as well. And we can go on in our lives without a big stone sitting on our chests.
One day passed. Nothing from the jury. Then two. Still nothing. And then finally, on day number three, a decision.
And when they walked out, I studied their faces, and I went, oh, no. Oh, no. We've lost. We've lost.
Department 103, people of the state of California versus...
And then the verdict was read.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Douglas Gordon Bradford, guilty of the crime of first-degree murder of Lynn Knight in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony as charged in count one of the information.
Doug Bradford submitted to handcuffs, took a last look at freedom, and was led away. No family here to weep or cry out or say goodbye. Even his attorney, Robert Shapiro, was conspicuously absent on vacation. It was almost 35 years to the day after the murder of Lynn Knight.
As he goes to jail, we're let out of jail. And this team did the most amazing job that could ever be done. It's a wonderful day. It's a wonderful, wonderful day. Thank you, people of Los Angeles, for being such good angels.
Jim Wallace packed away his last and perhaps most difficult case.
I felt grateful. You know, you don't work for your agency. You don't even work for personal pride in these things, because you're going to work some case regardless. You work for victims' families. And in the end, those are the one people who come up and give you a hug. Those are the people, you know, you never get closure.
And Gary Hilton, long into his own retirement, felt finally liberated, free of the case that had tortured him for so long.
I was thankful. It sort of allowed me to start putting the case away.
Why not? You've been carrying around that baggage all those years.
I want to put it back on that shelf.
Now it was time for someone else to carry that burden. The man who caused so much misery in the first place. In December 2014, Douglas Bradford was back in court one more time to be sentenced for the murder of Lynn Knight. Now wearing a yellow jail suit, not his business suit, but still defiant as ever as he indignantly addressed the court.
I want you to hear me speak now, very clearly and unambiguously, what my family and friends already know. I did not murder Lynn Knight. I'm an innocent man wrongly convicted. I'm mad as hell that I'm paying for someone else's crime. This is a horrendous, horrendous miscarriage of justice. Thank you.
But Bradford's words rang hollow with the judge, who, moments later, imposed a stiff sentence.
And the court does impose the statutory sentence of 25 years to life for the murder of Lynn Knight.
Which, all things considered, said John Lewin, isn't such a bad deal for Doug Bradford.
So in the end, what happened in this case was the defendant got his parole 35 years early. He lived a life that he never should have had. The right thing happened. He is in prison today. I don't think he'll ever get out. And sometimes that's the best we can do.
It's been a long journey. It's been a long journey. For 35 years of it always being there, to finally being able to let her go and dance with Mom and then that's real satisfaction. Real satisfaction.